I think Carl's got more German in him than he admits, you know. I told him last year I'd be here. I mean, how many times does he want to know? And as long as he's wearing that kilt, we're never going to look alike. Kind of. But I tell you, Carl and Nancy have done it to me again. They put me on a program with nothing but preachers. And that kind of worries me, because we know who they represent. I wonder who Carl and Nancy think I represent. I'm trying to get equal time to the devil or something here. The only thing I know about theology is what Brother Dave Gardner says. You know, somebody said, Brother Dave said, what's the difference between a Northern Baptist and a Southern Baptist? And Brother Dave says, the Northern Baptist says, there ain't no hell. And the Southern Baptist says, the hell there ain't. Before I get too serious, I wanted to tell you, you know, how many Southerners do you think that it takes to screw in one light bulb? The answer is four. It takes four. One to screw in the light bulb, one to write a song about it, and two to go out in the parking lot and get in a fight about it. So. God love us. I love the South and I love Southern. But I'll tell you a Yankee joke. It shows you what mean people they are. This is about two guys that were up on the New York on the Empire State Building. And they have a bar up there about 25 floors up in a terrace. You know how a building kind of gives up like that. And they have tables out there. And these two guys were out there drinking in business suits. That's what they wear up there. And had several drinks. And two of them just happened to be standing next to each other. And one of them turned to the other one. He says, you know, he says, this time of day, at this time of year, you can jump off the top of the building here. And when you fall, the updraft will slow you down and you can just glide right over onto the terrace. And the other guy says, I don't believe you. And he says, no, he says, it's true. He says, I'm an aeronautical engineer. He says, it's really true. This particular time of the year, at this particular time of day, there creates this tremendous updraft. And when somebody jumps off or falls off even, it would stop them about this level. The guy says, I don't believe you. So the other guy says, well, you stand right here and watch, and I'll show you. And he goes inside, he gets the elevator, he goes up to the top. He jumps off, falls come down, and sure enough, just about the time he got to that terrace, he just kind of leveled out, and he just kind of floated right over, right to where the guy was standing. And the guy says, my God, that's amazing. He says, I never would have believed that. He says, could I do that? The other guy says, sure, sure. So the other guy goes up there. He gets on top and jumps off, and he comes falling down, and he just goes right past the terrace. Shoo! Splat! Hits the sidewalk. The other guy is looking over at him and walks back over to the bar and orders another drink, and the bartender says, he says, you know, you ought not to drink, Superman, because you get real mean. Superman is a Yankee. But I wanted to share with you some things today and tomorrow about your Southern heritage. And one of the things that is the heritage of every Southerner is that we are the true heirs of the American Revolution. That's what our Confederate ancestors were fighting for. And we need to really make sure we understand that American Revolution. And there's two documents, you know, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The Declaration is a statement of the philosophy of the American Revolution. And the Constitution was a document or a framework that they used to try to implement that philosophy. And if you don't, if you try to separate the two, a guy wrote a letter to the editor the other day, and he said, "Oh, man doesn't have a God-given right to have a firearm." He says, "That's a government right." Well, that's because they don't understand the Declaration of Independence. And what does it say? It says, "All men are created equal," meaning they are created equal in the eyes of God. "And they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." And that was the revolutionary thing. That is the basic premise of the American Revolution, is that our rights come from God, not from the government or anywhere else, and not by any social compact. They come from God. By being virtue of being born, we are born with our God-given rights. And that's very important, because up to that point, rights had been considered a favor or a privilege granted by the government or by the king. And our philosophy was that they come from God. And that's why they're unalienable. If they're not from God, they're not unalienable. If you get a right from a government or a privilege or a favor, they can withdraw it. And it's really anything that can be withdrawn or taken back is not a right. The right is basic. Comes as part of your human nature. So that's the first thing. And the second thing was, the second premise of the American Revolution, is that the whole, entire, and only purpose of government is to protect those rights. The purpose of government is not to provide us with a house or medical care or, super highways. The purpose of government is to protect our rights. Protect them, not give them to us, because they come from God. Third premise, contained in the Declaration of Independence, when a government becomes abusive of those rights, then people have not only the right, but the duty to change it and to institute a government which will protect their rights. And that's the core of the American Revolution. And a lot of things follow from that that cause the conflict between the North and the South. One of those is that when you get to the Constitution, which was, as our previous speaker explained, is that it was a contract, a compact between the states that created an agent for the states to perform certain specific duties, mainly foreign policy and in time of war. The Southerner James Madison said in the Federalist Papers, he said the ratio of government will be 5% federal government, mainly in time of war, 95% states. So the states had created an agent for themselves. And from that, it follows that whatever that agent for the states does must be of equal benefit to all states. And if you read your Constitution, you look at the powers given to Congress, which is the main set of powers. They are all things that are common to all the states, like setting a standard monetary system, setting a standard of weights and measures, the interstate commerce clause, which was intended to just make sure we had a free market among the states, all of the common defense, all these things common. But it doesn't include pork barrel, what we call pork barrel. And that was one of the early conflicts between the North and the South, because the Southerners believed in that Constitution. They believed that you must obey it, that the government must be chained to that Constitution. And you had these people up north that got the idea and it's the prevailing idea today, that why you should use the government to enrich us. You know, let's build something that will help the economy, you know. And the South kept saying, no, you can't do that. You can't tax South Carolina and North Carolina to build a project in Pennsylvania that's only going to be a benefit to people in Pennsylvania. And you can't tax people in Pennsylvania to build something in Georgia that's only going to be a benefit to them. And so they would kill these projects. And it just enraged the North. It did. You can read editorials in the Northern newspapers, and this long before the Republicans stumbled on the idea of abolitionism as a, you know, a Trojan horse cause. And they are ranting and raving about the South. These guys keep blocking us from doing these things. You know, they're interfering with our economic growth. They were just enraged about it. The South, for example, would always block the Homestead Act. Now you may think, now that sounds real good. Government give land to people. By the way, it was a fraud because the record shows that 80% of the land given away under the Homestead Act ended up in the hands of a few corporations. But the Yankees were crooked. But the South said you can't do that because that public land belongs equally to all the people. And so whatever you do with it must be of benefit to all people. And the Southern idea was that you sell it. You don't have a right to give it to somebody. You sell it, and then the money goes in the Treasury to provide for the common defense. In fact, the Southerners believed that you could finance the federal government off tariff revenue, revenue tariffs, not protected tariffs, but just revenue tariffs, and the proceeds from the sale of public land. But that was a big conflict. But that, if in fact the federal government is the agent of the states and not a sovereign power itself, then, you know, it could not do that. And when the Confederates did secede and they drew up their own constitution, which is almost word for word like the original, except for some important changes. And one of the changes they made to prevent future Southern politicians from getting into that pork barrel business was that you could not, Congress could not initiate an appropriation for a new program or a new bureaucracy, except by a two-thirds vote. Otherwise, they could only fund the existing government at the request of the executive branch. So it was, they were serious about that. They didn't want pork barrel in the North. They didn't want it in the South. The other thing was that that Constitution had to be inviolate. And then once the states, some states said, we're not going to be bound by it, and then it was dissolved for everybody, you know. As our other speaker said, you know, if you got a man and a wife and one of them happens to be Bill Clinton, you know, the contract's broken. I mean, Hillary must like that White House an awful lot to put up with him. But when one party breaks a contract, it's broken for the other party. You know, that's really what our Southern forefathers did. They saw themselves as fighting a second American Revolution. They saw themselves as living up to the letter and the spirit of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And as he quoted Jefferson Davis, said, I love the Union, I love the Constitution, but I would rather leave with the Constitution than stay in the Union without it. And one of Lincoln's cabinet members said, among other things, he says, the Constitution is a worthless piece of parchment. And that's why in Europe, the War of Northern Aggression, and we didn't really lose that war, by the way. You may think we did, but we didn't. We just ran out of bullets before we ran out of Yankees. So we had time out, you know. But the European philosophers saw that war for what it was, that it was, and the Reconstruction that followed. It was America's French Revolution. And they said that. Lord Acton, who was a British political philosopher, you know, most people remember him because he said that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But after the war, he wrote General Robert E. Lee, and he said to General Lee, he said, "I grieve more for the government that was lost at Richmond than I rejoice for the government that was saved at Waterloo." Because he recognized that what the South was fighting for was a constitutional republic of sovereign states, of divided sovereignty, and that what the North was doing was the same thing the French Revolution did and Napoleon did. It was imposing by brute force a single sovereign unitary government. And that's what's happened. That's what happened. And the Reconstruction, which I'm going to talk about more tomorrow, I don't want to talk about it tonight because it makes you hate Yankees, and you shouldn't go to bed. Shouldn't go to bed hating people. But that war and that Reconstruction destroyed the Constitution, and it destroyed the Constitutional Republic, and it violated every single principle of the Declaration of Independence. Now, you will hear modern politicians like Bob Dole, for example, you know, he said, "Oh, I keep a copy of the Tenth Amendment in my wallet." Well, that just shows you how ignorant Bob Dole is, because the Tenth Amendment was rendered null and void by the 14th Amendment. That's the one they use, the federal courts use, as an excuse to apply federal jurisdiction to every aspect of human life. And so it's pointless to talk about the 10th Amendment unless you're going to repeal the 14th. And they're not about to do that because they know what they're doing. And one thing I want to impress upon you, that when bad things happen, they don't happen by accident. The status quo is the status quo because people want it that way. You know, I know a lot of good-hearted people think, "Well, gee whiz, those poor souls, they're just ignorant. And if they knew the truth, they'd fix it." They know the truth. They know what they're doing. They're after power. And they got it. And they're not going to give it up voluntarily. But we'll talk to them about that. But that's the key. And what replaced that constitutional republic was a unitary state which became an empire quickly. The same two guys, Sherman and Sheridan, who had burned and plundered and destroyed the South, as soon as we were prostrate, and as soon as we were under federal occupation, they went out to the West and they burned and plundered and destroyed the Native American tribes out there. It was Phil Sheridan who said, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." It was Phil Sheridan and General Sherman who said, "If we destroy the buffalo, we'll destroy the Indians." And they inaugurated that great slaughter of the buffalo. They're the ones that encouraged buffalo hunting. Although I don't understand how you could call it hunting, because how could you hunt a great big old bison in a grassy plain? I mean, they ought to be pretty obvious. But anyway. But they did. They brutally destroyed that buffalo because they knew then the Plains Indians would be faced with a choice of either starvation or surrender. On the reservations and living off government beef, which of course they cheated them on, as they were stealing and plundering in the South, they didn't even give the Indians a fair shake even after they had forced them on the reservation. But that's that same Yankee greedy mentality, that same empire. And the next thing was what? The Spanish-American War. You know, "Oh, we're going to liberate Cuba." Cubans hadn't asked us to liberate. There was a minority of Cubans, you know, who wanted to throw the Spanish out. And that's why it took the American army to go down there and throw them out, because Cubans weren't that interested in doing it. Puerto Ricans hadn't asked for our help. But what we did was we just took the Spanish Empire, because that was a convenient empire to take, because Spain was weak. And we could go in there and take their empire away, and there wouldn't be anything they could do about it. And so we got Puerto Rico, we had the Philippines, and we had to kill, after we drove the Spanish out, after we drove the Spanish out in the Philippines, we had to kill tens of thousands of Filipinos who were trying to drive us out. Empire. That's what it is, empire. And then the next war, we get involved in the wars in Europe, which were wars of empire. And one of the big lies of this time is you'll hear people say, oh, nationalism causes war. Internationalism is good. You hear that. Your children are being taught that in education. But what was World War I and World War II? They were wars of empire. So we're not nationalist wars. They were wars of empire. It was an attempt by Germany in Europe to build an empire that could compete with the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, the French Empire, the Belgian Empire. And in the Pacific, in World War II, it was Japan trying to build an empire that could compete with the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, the French Empire, and the American Empire. It was a clash of empires. It wasn't a clash of nations. It was a clash, a conflict of empires. And what do we have today in this empire, this American empire? We have, for the first time, we have American soldiers stationed in 100 foreign countries. 100 foreign countries. And they were sent there by a draft dodger. Now, none of those countries are at war with us. None of those countries were threatening to go to war with us. Why are our soldiers? They're running errands for the United Nations. You know, we sent American soldiers down to Haiti to pick up their... You see, I'm not a preacher. I have to stop myself every once in a while. To pick up their garbage and to dig their latrines and clean out their septic tanks while 3 million unemployed Haitians stood around and watched them. Now that's crazy. Now you had a young boy named Michael New. I'm sure most of you have heard of him. An honorable soldier. Served in the Gulf War. They got orders to go transfer you to a UN outfit in Macedonia. He went to his commanding officer. Didn't want to create a stink. He went quietly, went through the chain of command. He says, sir, he says, I cannot in good conscience wear a UN uniform and serve under a UN officer. I took my oath to the United States. So please either transfer me to another unit or let me take an honorable discharge. No, the Army said. Neither one. You will go to Macedonia. You will wear the UN Blue Beret. You will carry a UN identification card. And you will serve under this Finnish officer who's going to be in charge of it. Or we'll court-martial. And he said, we'll court-martial. And they did. And that is court-martial's on appeal. Now, all these great defenders of the Constitution in the House and Senate, except for one or two, have kept their darn mouth shut. They didn't raise one finger to help this boy. You would have thought, even for just partisan purposes, they might have done it. Because it was clearly shown that Clinton was using a lie. He has been known to lie, you know. There's two paragraphs in the legislation that authorizes American troops. One is it has to be under paragraph 7 or under paragraph 5. You have to get permission of Congress. And Clinton was claiming this was a paragraph 7 situation when in fact it was paragraph 5. And he should have gotten permission of Congress, and he didn't. Because they don't care. And Congress didn't care. So we are living with the results, you know, of the surrender at Appomattox. And that's a kind of a final point I want you to remember. Because we tend sometimes to think about history and we think, well, let's go back and we'll look at history, and gee, that's all over with. I wish it had come out differently, but it's all over with. It's not all over with. It's still going on. You're still being reconstructed. You're still being denied a constitutional republic. You're still being denied the right to live in a sovereign state. You're still being denied, really, the right to govern yourself. Because all of that power has been usurped by the federal government in Washington. For example, the state of Texas, which is having a fearful problem with illegal immigration. Several years back, they said, well, maybe it will discourage the illegal immigration if we will deny public schooling and non-emergency state services to illegal aliens. Makes sense. Why should a criminal, someone who is violating the law, receive the exact same services as a citizen? So they pass that law. State of Texas. Federal judge comes in and says, null and void. You can't do that. Provide the services. We order you to provide the service. And they had nullified, you know, they passed the anti-affirmative action thing. They shop around federal judge and says, no, it's nullified. In Colorado, they passed a law that says, you know, we don't think sweet boys are a minority. And the federal judge, bam, you can't do that. You know, what can the legislature do? The whole issue of abortion is a case of usurpation. The Constitution does not legislate. Legislation is really moral and philosophical decisions. You know, we have a moral philosophical position against murder and rape, so we legislate against that. And that's a good answer when somebody says, well, you need a lawyer. You don't need a lawyer because lawyers are not trained to make moral and philosophical decisions. You know. All due respect to my good friends, you know, who make a living in the law, the law schools today teach people to be amoral. And, you know, what's the client? What's the argument? Doesn't matter. They switch sides back and forth. But legislation is supposed to represent morality and philosophy, positions. And that's why there's nothing about abortion in the Constitution. The Constitution is a charter of government. It's about structure. It's about who does what. But it's not about all the human problems that result in legislation. There's nothing in there about abortion. There's nothing in there about education. There's nothing in the Constitution about welfare. There's nothing in the Constitution about health care. There's nothing in there because the Constitution never contemplated the federal government dealing with those issues. Those issues were to be dealt with by the sovereign states in their own legislative process. And in the case of abortion, you had some states wouldn't allow it. Some states did allow it. And the Supreme Court comes along and says, oh, there's a penultimate of privacy, and those states that don't allow abortion, you know, they're violating privacy and therefore null and void. In other words, the Constitution means whatever five of nine justices say it means. And that in itself is unconstitutional. That's usurpation. Here's an interesting side effect. Federal judiciary has no power to enforce its rules. You know, you think they do because they can hold you in contempt and the marshals will come get you. But those marshals don't work for the federal courts. They work for the attorney general who is appointed, who works for the president. In other words, if you had a president in the executive branch who said, I'm not going to enforce that, then it would not get enforced. And that actually happened in American history. Again, a Southerner did it, Andrew Jackson. Now, Andrew Jackson liked Indians only marginally more than he liked British, and he hated the British. And Congress passed a law that said that they were going to remove the Indians from Georgia and Alabama, Mississippi, out to Oklahoma. And the Cherokees, who were very advanced at that time, filed suit in federal court. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that law, removing those Indians, is unconstitutional. And you know what Andrew Jackson said? He said, that's Chief Justice John Marshall's rule. Let him enforce it. But in the meantime, as Commander-in-Chief, I'm ordering the Army to move the damn Indians out to Oklahoma. And he did. And there was nothing the Supreme Court could do about it. And that would be true today. If you had a president today who told the Supreme Court, you can make any ruling you want to, I'm not going to enforce it. There would be nothing they could do about it. Yeah. But that'll be the day when we ever elect a president. You know, speaking of president, you know, you talk about Andrew Jackson. And he loved his wife, Rachel. You know, and you were in mortal danger if you said anything derogatory about Rachel. And one guy, and so Jackson's political enemies who wanted to get him killed would get these famous duelists to say something insulting about Rachel. And in one case, I've forgotten the guy's name, but this guy had killed 26 people. And he said something about Rachel, and Jackson challenged him to a duel. And they thought, aha, you know, this guy will kill Jackson. We'll be rid of him. But Jackson knew the guy would shoot first, so he, the night before the duel, he took the buttons off his coat. And he wore those long coats. And he sewed them back on 3 inches lower than they would normally be. Charles Dickinson, right. So they had the duel. Dickinson turned around and fired and hit Jackson 3 inches below the heart. He would have been right where his heart, he would have killed him. But because of the buttons, he was 3 inches low. And Jackson stood there holding that gaping 50 caliber hole and leveled his pistol and killed him. And then he collapsed. And when he came to, his doctor said, he said, Andy, he said, I don't see how you stayed on your feet. And I'm going to have to use Jackson's language. This is a quote, preachers. It's not me talking to him. And Andy said, I'd have stayed on my feet long enough to kill that son of a bitch, even if he just shot me in the brain. But that's all part of our proud Southern heritage. But I do want you to think about this, and I'm going to wind this thing up. But I was talking to Bill back here. And by the way, please buy something from Bill, because I'll tell you a secret he wouldn't tell you. But he got an invitation to go to a much bigger event, and he turned them down to come down here to be with us. But Bill and I were talking this afternoon, and he said, you know, all we've got left is the truth. That's right. We don't have the politicians. We don't have the big money guys. All we've got is the truth. And that's true. And I tell you, there's something terrible about the truth. And I'm not going to get into preaching. But once you know the truth, you can't ever unknow it. So it forces you to make a decision. You know, if you don't know something, then you can say, well, don't blame me, I didn't know it. But once you know it, like once you know about God and Jesus, and you turn your back then, you know, it's Katie bar the door. And once you know the truth that the South was right, it was right about the Constitution, it was right about secession, it was right about the concept of human rights. It was right about how the federal government should always go. Then once you know that, then you cannot stand by with a clear conscience and hear people slander the South or slander these flags, which are noble flags, which men shed their blood, not for slavery, but for liberty, for the Constitution. And I tell you, I've already seceded again. I am not going to be reconstructed. I don't go up north. I don't travel up there. I'm not taking a vacation up there. I'm not accepting a speaking engagement up there. I ain't going up there. I don't like them. You know? I'm standing within the confines of the Mason-Dixon line. And I don't care what they do up there. You know, they can tax themselves right on end of perdition. And I hope they do. You know, I just don't want them. You know what they do is they mess up their own states and then they come down here and try and mess up ours. I told you, I have the misfortune of working with some people from up north, New York City. And I was sort of teasing this young woman about the Southern League, you know, and secession. And she said in her loud, abrasive New York City voice, you know, "Yeah, well, it's too late. You know, there's too many of us down here. Ha, ha, ha." And I said, "Honey, you don't understand." I said, "Once we secede, we can deport you." But I do. I want you all to understand that we have to provide the leadership. You know, if there's any hope in all seriousness for this country to ever go back to a constitutional republic, it lies with Southerners, because it's our heritage, and our Celtic blood wants to be free, you know. And if we don't provide the leadership, you know, it's not coming from California or New York. If we don't stand up for faith-based Christianity, you know, it's not going to come from the New England Transcendentalists or the California gurus. You know, we're the last outpost of Christendom. We're the last outpost of people who love liberty and who still respect the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And so I want to close with this thought. R.L. Dabney, when he addressed a young crowd of graduates at Davidson College, and he wound up his speech, he said, "Young men, you have no reason to be ashamed of your Confederate ancestors. See to it they have no reason to be ashamed of you."